The experience of anxiety has captured people's attention for millennia. From ancients like Hippocrates to icons like Freud, the feeling of overwhelming dread, fear, or nerves has been as perplexing as it has been common.
Today, anxiety disorders are the most common mental health problem in the United States. At 40 million diagnoses, it's something that almost 20% of adults will experience. While it might be widespread, it's not something that people always feel comfortable talking about.
Scott Stossel, the editor of The Atlantic magazine, chose to share his personal experience with anxiety in his new book called My Age of Anxiety: Fear, Hope, Dread, and the Search for Peace of Mind. A successful author and journalist, Scott's description of debilitating dread and phobia has struck a chord with readers across the country and has been what he describes as a coming-out experience. Scott's here with us now. Welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you've suffered from anxiety attacks for years, and to start sort of at square one, for people who are lucky enough not to know what panic attacks feel like, can you describe what it's like for you?
Sure. I mean, they can vary a little bit, but fundamentally, it is as though your brain and your body has been hijacked by the fight or flight response. I mean, in effect, it's kind of, in some ways, it's an evolutionarily adaptive response, the feeling of the fight or flight response, which Darwin and early doctors like Walter Cannon identified, that, you know, prepares you to run away from a saber-toothed tiger that's attacking you, or to fight if an enemy tribe. But when it comes on spontaneously in the form of a panic attack, or an attack that's triggered by some phobic stimulus, it's this sort of awful panoply of cognitive symptoms where your thoughts start racing and you can't think and you can't concentrate and things sort of seem unreal. And then what's worse for me often are the physical symptoms where you can start sweating uncontrollably and trembling and even, you know, shaking quite violently, and you have gastric distress and you get dizzy and you get tingling in your hands and feet, and you can have a whole range of other symptoms. And many people, you know, the first time that it happens to them, they think that maybe they're having a heart attack and end up rushing to the emergency room, only to be told that they're happily just having an anxiety attack. But even though it's, you know, benign compared to a heart attack, it's not in itself physically dangerous. It can be terrifying while you're experiencing one.
Well, and you had one at an especially bad moment. I mean, I'm sure there have been many bad moments, because there's never a good moment to have a panic attack, but you had one at your wedding. Can you tell us that story?
Sure. I mean, it was, and this was, there's what's known as kind of spontaneous or internally cued panic attacks, which happen where you don't actually know what's triggering them, or sometimes, you know, it's some unconscious thought or some physiological blip in your body. In this case, it was triggered concretely by the fear of standing in front of, you know, the 300 or so guests that we'd invited to our wedding who were coming to watch us get married. And, you know, it was very, very hot in the wedding. So I was already in the church, it was July, so I was already sweating a little bit. And as my wife is sort of walking down the aisle, you know, the sweat is starting to drip and drip and flow. And, you know, my thought process is, oh, my God, you know, you start to develop the fear of the fear. This is a very common phenomenon of many anxiety disorders, and particularly panic disorder, where you become afraid of the fear itself. And that's what happened in this instance. And it very quickly sort of cycles out of control, where I'm thinking, oh, my God, I'm going to be humiliated. Everyone's looking at me. They can see that I'm sweating. This means I'm not suitable. You know, all the thoughts that they've had about how I'm not worthy of my wife-to-be are being confirmed. And then, you know, I can see the minister looking at me. And I think in my head, I'm probably at the time was overestimating what other people's responses are. In fact, you know, a characteristic of anxiety is that you tend to be very inward focused and, you know, kind of unhelpfully narcissistic. But eventually my symptoms got so bad that, you know, my best man is handing me a Kleenex to try to wipe my sweat, and the minister is kind of looking down at me and mouthing quietly, like, are you okay? And my wife is literally physically having to hold me up because I'm shaking.
Oh, boy.
And, and then by that point, I'm not really present in the moment, and it's just sort of horrifying. And then afterwards, you feel this kind of self-loathing for having, you know, messed up what should have been, you know, one of the most important moments of my life, and, you know, ruined it for both me and my wife, although we've gotten long past that now.
Well, and at least it's comforting, or maybe it's not, but you're not alone in this. Can you tell us about how widespread panic disorders, anxiety is for people in this country and beyond?
Well, the collectively, the anxiety disorders, and that's, you know, the set of different diagnoses as defined by the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, they are post-traumatic stress disorder, OCD, panic disorder, generalized anxiety disorder, and simple phobia. And the sort of distinctions between those are not always clear cut. But basically, altogether, probably one in six adult Americans are estimated at some point to will suffer from an anxiety disorder for some period of time. And then it ranges in its degree. There are people who are so anxious that they are housebound for years and are unable to function and can't work in a workplace. There are other people like me who are most of the time, quite high functioning, particularly people with panic disorder for whatever reason. It's part of the kind of characterological characteristics of it that they often are very good at hiding it when you're not actually having a panic attack. You're at great pains to try to conceal what you believe is the sort of anxious, embarrassing, shameful person within. And so you do that by projecting an outward presence of calm, competence. So as you mentioned at the top of the show, I'm 44 years old. I, in effect, stayed in the closet about this for most of my life, even though I'd spent years enduring different kinds of therapies, and people very close to me knew. And I always sort of thought that some other people must suspect a little bit, but I was shocked when early copies of the book started circulating, and I had colleagues coming into my room in my office saying, we just had absolutely no idea. So it's quite possible to conceal these things very effectively. Part of what I'm doing I didn't set out to do this, but in effect, I'm realizing that by writing this book and now being open about this, I'm hoping to sort of diminish some of the stigma attached to anxiety disorders and to mental illness more generally, and to demonstrate to people that, A, if you feel this way, you're not alone. There's help for you. There's plenty of other people who suffer, it doesn't necessarily have to be an impediment to having an effective life.
Since you have kind of put this out there for everybody to know, your colleagues and the whole world, do you feel like your anxiety has gotten less? Or if you're in a position where you do feel anxious, at any moment you can say, you'll have to excuse me, I'm having some anxiety right now, and then maybe that might calm things down.
That's a very interesting question. I've thought about it a lot, and the jury is still out, I guess, is the short answer. But the irony is I kind of conceived the idea of writing this book 10 years ago when I was in, quaking dread of my first book tour. And now, I ended up spending, 6 or 7 years writing this book. And now here I am rewarded with another book tour. what I'm hoping that the difference is this time is, A, I have more practice, but also as you just said, I feel like if at some point I were to have to walk off stage or, hang up on you during this radio show, I or you could just say, well, refer to chapter 4 and you'll understand exactly what's going on. But so in that respect, it has been somewhat liberating. And also just the number of people, both people that I know and some celebrities actually, and then far more people I don't know, strangers just writing in to say, thank you, this has been so helpful to me. It sort of helps to salve the shame component of it. On the other hand, though, one component of people who have kind of aspects of social anxiety disorders, what you fear is having people scrutinize you carefully. And so, and this is the nature of my nutty, anxious mind, is that now when I go out there, even though I'm aware I can, maybe it's not such a horrible thing if I just say, sorry, I'm having a panic attack or an anxious moment, but I'm always wondering, okay, are people noticing, are they looking extra closely to see a sweat beating on my lip? Is my voice quivering? Am I starting to shake visibly? So I'm sort of inviting the kind of scrutiny that I'm most terrified of. But I suppose in the fullness of time, that could prove to be very good exposure therapy, which is what many phobias call for.
Right, so it can be a kind of a loop. Well, let me tell you, if you hang up on this interview, I'm totally fine with it. I've had panic attacks myself, and I know where you're coming from, and lots of artists have had them as well. Do you think it's part of having a creative life, being someone who is more sensitive and prone to anxiety?
There's been a lot written about that, going back to Aristotle, who postulated that there was some connection between creativity and mental illness of various kinds. And it's not fully provable, but there's a woman actually at the University of Iowa named Nancy Andreessen, who's a neuroscientist, and she's been studying what makes super creative people that way, and she's looking at both kind of literary writers and artists and also people in fields like physics and economics, and what are the sources of their great creativity. And interestingly, there was much less correlation between high IQ and this sort of creativity than there was between when she would look at their brains in an MRI machine. It showed they were using a more disparate part of their brain. They're sort of associating, drawing on more different parts of the brain. And interestingly, that seems to be also correlated with various forms of mental illness. And when she looked at the families of the people that she studied, it turns out that even if some of these artists and economists weren't themselves mentally ill, they had a much higher percentage of relatives than average with mental illness, which suggests that there is some correlation in some way that we don't fully understand yet between mental illness of various kinds and creativity. With anxiety, I think, in particular, it can, you know, it can be a motivator because you're always trying to outrun your fear of failure. But also, you have acute social antennae. I mean, I talk a lot with my sister, has a struggles with anxiety, particularly of a social sort, and she calls it her talking problem. And she gets into a social situation, and she's extremely intelligent, but she'll sort of freeze up and be unable to think of what to say because she's so worried about what the other person is thinking mm-hmm. about her, and she sees them stifling a yawn or a twitch of disdain. And the truth is that psychologically healthy people may have an adaptively blunted perception of reality, that socially anxious people may be so good at picking up on these subtle social cues that are in fact there, but that you're better off just not noticing. So that could translate too into things that, you know, help with creative arts and other things.
We're talking right now with Scott Stossel about his new book, My Age of Anxiety, which explores his personal experience with debilitating anxiety.
And we want to hear from you. Have you experienced anxiety? Were you able to overcome it? How does it affect your daily life? And do you have questions for Scott about his experience? You can call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation after a look at some of the latest news with reporter Kristen Durst.
Federal prosecutors have escalated their criminal investigation into allegations that Governor Chris Christie's aides created traffic jams as political payback. Subpoenas have been issued for his reelection campaign and the state Republican leadership. A lawyer who represents the campaign says the subpoenas seek documents related to the closure of traffic lanes near the George Washington Bridge. Law enforcement officials say threatening phone calls prompted an alert at Colorado's Columbine High School for a time today. In 1999, two students opened fire at Columbine, killing 12 classmates and a teacher, and wounding 26 others before killing themselves in the school's library. School received the first phone call at 10 a.m., and others came over the next 2 to 3 minutes. The lockout was lifted after 2 p.m. Governor Scott Walker has called a special session of the legislature to consider his $500 million property and income tax plan. Walker announced his special session today, one day after he detailed his plan during his State of the State speech. For Central Time, I'm Kristen Durst.
We talk about issues in the news and topics that improve the quality of our lives.
Wait a second. I thought I lived in a democracy. I thought that I had rights. But most of those rights, or many of them, have been taken away from us, or we voluntarily have handed them over.
I want these kids off of my lawn, and I want it to stop sleeting and snowing. Those are the only two things that I ask right now.
Add your voice to the mix of lively guests with different perspectives.
The Joy Cardine Show, weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Contributors to WPR include Hooper Corporation, providing electric power and mechanical construction services to commercial, industrial, renewable energy, and utility customers nationwide. Hooper Corporation, a Wisconsin company since 1913.
Take Wisconsin Public Radio on the go wherever you go. Listen to our live broadcasts, our archived programs, and the latest from WPR News. Go to WPR.org/mobile app to download.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're back now with Scott Stossel talking about his new book, My Age of Anxiety, in which he shares his personal experience with debilitating anxiety.
And we'd like to hear from you on this. What is your experience with anxiety, Ben? What has worked? Were you able to overcome out the other side of it, or is it something that just keeps coming back over and over? And why do you think anxiety is running rampant in our culture today? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And we'll go to the phones right now. We'll go first to Jeff in Milwaukee. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good evening.
Hello.
My question is, I've been dealing with, well, I was originally, I guess they told me I was clinically depressed. Then I was labeled with OCD, and I guess off and on through my life, and I'm almost 50 now, but I still regularly have panic and, phobia-stemmed panic attacks, but situational phobia or situational anxiety. And I'm wondering if there's anything, I know like you talked about actually some of the stuff, just being able to, or getting out and doing the stuff.
Sounds like you're wondering what works.
What works? I mean, I'd rather not be on a antidepressant or anti-anxiety for the rest of my life.
All right, well, let's see what our guest has to say. And I know, Scott, that you have pretty much tried it all. What would you say to someone like Jeff who's looking for some relief?
Well, I have tried many, many things, and I have to say candidly that nothing has cured me. But there are many things, both from my own experience and from my extensive reading, that I can say can be very helpful. And, you know, let me say up front that I'm not a physician, and that a physician is always the best person to, you know, make these kind of recommendations. But there are a whole host of both, you know, ways of taking care of yourself and also therapies that you can seek. And you mentioned medication. I mean, I have relied off and on, and you know, mostly on over the course of, you know, some 30 years, many different classes of medication, and some of them have worked for me some of the time very effectively. But you know, Jeff is right that there's still astonishingly little knowledge about how exactly they work, what the long-term effects on our brains are. A lot of them have debilitating side effects and can create dependency. And so, and there are many people too, therapists and critics of the drug industry, who will say, you know, actually all you're doing with drugs is treating, you're masking the symptoms. You're not really treating the underlying anxiety. I think there may be something to that, but for me and for many, many other people, benzodiazepines and antidepressants, benzodiazepines being sort of like Xanax and Clonopin, which are an anti-anxiety medication, can be very effective at reducing the physical symptoms. One form of therapy that much of the literature is focusing on now, and that is showing to be, you know, as effective, if not more so than medication, with fewer side effects and maybe longer lasting effects, is something called cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT. And basically that's a form of talk therapy where you work with a therapist to expose yourself to the things that you fear, including panic attacks, you know, stimulating them artificially if you can, and then learning that you can cope with them and changing your thought processes so they don't go running down these negative, you know, a lot of people with anxiety tend to have very negative thought patterns that they cycle into, and CBT can help cancel that out. Another thing that I have not, that I'm actually quite hopeful about for myself and haven't given enough of a shot, because I'm struck by the powerful accounts in the literature, and that's various forms of meditation. And, you know, this is something that comes from the East, but what they now call mindfulness meditation, which is just kind of, they're all different kinds of meditation, but it's basically sort of accepting the anxiety and doing, you know, focused breathing work. And the most interesting study to me is they had a bunch of novice meditators just do a short course of learning how to meditate. And after like a month, they interviewed all these meditators, and they all reported, or almost all of them reported, that they had higher levels of well-being, lower levels of anxiety. And then they put them in an fMRI machine where you can look at their brain, and they actually saw that literally the size of their amygdala, which is the sort of seat of fear in the brain, mm-hmm. had shrunk, and the density of neuronal of connections in the front of the brain had increased. So here's clear kind of Western empirical evidence that an Eastern technique works. And
now, then, Scott, you said you had tried that, or you haven't yet?
I have, in a kind of half, not serious enough way. I've done various kinds of meditation, and it does help. I mean, breathing, when you're in a panicky moment, or if you're in situational anxiety, learning how to do the right kind of breathing can actually help calm your physiology. And of course, you know, the irony is the more anxious you are, the harder it is to have that, you know, take effect and work effectively. But just two other things that are actually, you know, based from my own personal experience and from reading, you know, getting, and this sounds like stuff that your mother or grandmother have told you, but get enough sleep. There's, you know, the amount of evidence about sleep deprivation and anxiety is like becoming, you know, greater and greater. And of course, it can become a cyclical thing, because if you're anxious, you have insomnia, and if you have insomnia, then you have worse anxiety, and that can kind of cycle out of control. And get regular exercise. Again, okay. That's good for your physical health.
Sleep and exercise. I'm just going to jump in there, because we have so many people who want to talk to you, and we're running out of time. So let's go to Lynn in Milwaukee. Hi, Lynn, you're next. And, oh, Jeff, thank you for calling, and good luck to you. Appreciate that call. Hi, Lynn.
Hi. You know, I was calling because I wonder how many people are highly sensitive people, as they call it. In New Agey, they call it empaths. People who just are kind of overwhelmed by sensations and feelings of other people, and that translates into anxiety. So like an empath or a highly sensitive person literally can feel other people's kind of feelings, and it gives them anxiety. So I guess what I'm saying is I would assume that people who have anxiety, there's a different root causes for people. And I think that identifying those highly sensitive people and giving them tools for how to deal with that might help some people who have anxiety.
Okay. Thank you, Lynn. That's a good point. And the highly sensitive people, it sounds as though that could have some correlation there with anxiety. So, Scott, what do you know about that? And do we even have a handle on where anxiety comes from?
Well, there actually is a scale called the ASI, or Anxiety Sensitivity Indicator, and it sort of relates to what that caller was just saying. And it's precisely that. Anxious people tend to be much more overwhelmed by all kinds of sensations, whether that's inputs from the world or things going on within their own bodies. They are just more sensitized. And again, that can be maybe what leads to creative gifts in some folks, but it can often lead to just physical unpleasantness in a lot of others. And learning how to control that, whether through meditation, exercise, medication, just, taking care of yourself is important at tamping that down.
All right. And Scott, as you go along and you've had this big journey and you're still in the middle of it, what advice would you give people who are going through crippling anxiety sometimes? We've got about a minute left.
Well, first of all, if you're in dire distress, seek help from either your family physician, or there's an organization that's a nonprofit called the ADAA, which is the Anxiety and Depression Association of America, and they don't represent any single point of view. They're completely ecumenical in their approach, and they will just give you information about anxiety and can help hook you up with a therapist if that's what you want. But basically what I was saying earlier, take care of yourself, seek help if you're in severe distress, and know that, you are not alone. There are 40 million of us out there in the U.S., now, then there's the rest of the world. And one of the things that I've found most consoling about working on this book is that I found all these characters throughout history, from Sigmund Freud and William James and Charles Darwin, who sort of were motivated by their own anxious struggles to, seek new theories of mind, to, all kinds of doctors and great men and women from deep into history. So this is, it's part of the human condition, and it has redeeming qualities too, that, so when you're feeling miserable, recognize that there are gifts that may come with your anxiety as well, as debilitated as you may feel.
Scott, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for talking about this openly.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We've been speaking with Scott Stossel, editor of The Atlantic Magazine and the author of My Age of Anxiety. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up in today's installment of Hidden Wisconsin, we'll get a taste of what it means to be an aerial kite photographer.
First, last night was Governor Walker's State of the State address. As expected, Walker emphasized the state budget surplus and his proposal to cut taxes.
Walker did bring up one new proposal that we haven't heard much about before. It's called the Better Bottom Line Initiative. It aims at providing funds for job training and employment for people with disabilities in Wisconsin. Here to give us a sense of what this might accomplish is Lisa Pugh. She's Public Policy Coordinator at Disability Rights Wisconsin. Lisa, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, where does Wisconsin stand now when it comes to job training and employment for people with disabilities?
I think our numbers in terms of employment participation in the workforce are pretty comparable to what's happening nationally. We have pretty low employment rates for people with disabilities. The Bureau of Labor Statistics shows us that 18.7% approximately of people with disabilities are in the employment workforce, compared to 68% for people without disabilities. I think where our numbers are a little bit worse, actually, we're in the bottom half of states, is that we have many fewer employees with disabilities who are working at typical wage jobs in the community. I think we heard Governor Walker say last night that his initiative isn't about charity. It's about really people with disabilities bringing value to employers and to the workforce. So we're hoping we can see an increase in that type of employment, people working at typical wages in the community jobs.
What does the initiative hope to accomplish? What are some of the main points that have you interested in what we know so far from the governor?
Well, first of all, we're very excited that this is one of the main themes of the governor's initiatives over the next year. We think that for too long, people with disabilities have been an overlooked part of the workforce and that they can bring great skills and values to employers. So we're extremely excited. I think what you heard the governor say is that he wants something that focuses on employers. He talked a lot about really successful employers in Wisconsin, employers like Walgreens. Manpower Incorporated is another employer in Wisconsin who's doing a really great job employing people with disabilities. I think we'll see the governor using models like that, showcasing employers that have figured out that employees with disabilities really do add to the bottom line. We know that there's less turnover rate for employees with disabilities than the typical worker. In fact, it's about 8% to 48% in terms of turnover, pretty significant savings that a company can experience just by bringing in that skilled, eager worker with a disability. So I think you'll hear a lot of talk about that. We hope the governor will be making some additional investments in training and outreach to employers. And also promoting some of the really great projects that exist in Wisconsin, including Project Search and the Walgreens Ready initiative.
The governor was inspired in part, he acknowledged, by the governor of Delaware, meeting him at a national governor's meeting. Are you familiar with the program in Delaware, and what kind of success has it had?
Yes, we're really, really supportive of the Governor's Association Better Bottom Line initiative. That was a blueprint for governors that was unveiled at the National Governors Association Conference in November in Milwaukee, actually. And Governor Markell talked to other governors about some of the initiatives. It really is a blueprint for what governors can do in their states to kind of improve disability employment. And I think the whole theme is that we want to get more people with disabilities in our workforce because it ultimately can reduce reliance on public benefits and relieve some pressure in other areas of state government and public programs. So that's really what that blueprint is about. It asks states to kind of look at their own hiring and contracting practices. We hope Governor Walker will do that. Let's look at how the state is contracting. Are we encouraging state contract businesses to hire people with disabilities? And also within state agencies, are we hiring people with disabilities? And are we tracking how well we're doing? Are we setting benchmarks for doing a better job in terms of use of public dollars to support the employment of people with disabilities? That's what's in that governor's blueprint, and I think we'll see Governor Walker kind of follow some of those steps.
I think this is the kind of announcement where some people might look and say it's a state of the state address in an election year. It sounds nice, but it's just kind of window dressing. It's a nice little campaign thing. Do you think it's that, or do you think there's some real change that's going to happen with this initiative?
Well, I've heard Governor Walker talk about this many times prior to the state of the state, and the lieutenant governor has also been out talking to employers about this. They've brought Walgreens in. Walgreens nationally has seen a 120% productivity increase at its distribution centers when they did some intentional hiring of people with disabilities. So we've seen some real action already prior to last night. And again, I think when the governor said last night, this is not about charity, this is about the value employees with disabilities bring to the workforce, I think that there is some commitment there to make this more than just about a speech. And certainly disability organizations will be there to make sure that that happens.
Looking back on this, maybe a year from now or 2 years, what would success look like to you?
I think success would look like young people with disabilities in school would be able to have the same dreams as young people without disabilities. They'd be able to think about their skills and their strengths and their interests, work with their school, and then if they need supports in the adult system as they become adults, that those would be there so that they could be employed in a variety of businesses. And then we in the community would see a variety of people with disabilities working throughout our day in the community in different jobs. I think it would make for much richer communities and certainly a healthier life out of poverty for people with disabilities.
Now, I imagine there might be employers or managers out there listening right now thinking, this sounds great. I would love to open my workplace. I'd like to hire people with disabilities. I have no idea where to start in making an accessible and welcoming workplace. Can you share some advice for them?
Well, I think that In the last legislative session, you saw some bipartisan support for additional funding to go to the state's Division of Vocational Rehabilitation. People call those DVR services. So there are DVR services available to people with disabilities across the state. Those folks are really the experts in connecting skilled workers with disabilities to businesses. There are business consultants that work with DVR, and they really help a business to understand how to be more accessible, maybe even work with an individual to make sure that a work setting has the right accommodations for them individually, and they can really help the business better understand how to be more welcoming to people with disabilities overall. I guess we also hope that the governor's initiative does some of that work as well, kind of reaches out to businesses, kind of deals with some of the misconceptions about hiring people with disabilities. We hear from businesses sometimes that there are concerns about liability or concerns about accommodation costs. A lot of those are myths. And so I think the state and the DVR can play a role in really helping businesses to learn from other businesses that have been successful.
Been looking at it kind of from that positive angle. From the negative side, are businesses aware, our own business owners aware of employment discrimination laws when it comes to people with disabilities?
I think that's going to be an area of awareness and education. Again, I think that's a role that the state can play in terms of educating employers. Certainly, you know, when the governor pointed out Walgreens and some of the other employers last night, those are the employers that we're going to have to rely on in order to, you know, bring other businesses along. And certainly, you know, our organization, Disability Rights Wisconsin, plays a role in helping to ensure that people with disabilities are not discriminated against. But I think, you know, looking at it proactively, we really need to educate employers so they know, you know, how to be good employers and how to follow the law. And I think really Wisconsin can make a lot of progress here.
You know, I want to leave with this. If there's someone out there, a person with a disability who's maybe a little stymied about the job market, where to start, what their rights are, where's a good place for them to start?
I really think it's that initial connection with the Division of Vocational Rehabilitation. There are DVR counselors all across the state. The folks could also go to their workforce development boards and make some inquiries to understand what the workforce needs are. But I would definitely get connected with DVR. I think there's new money there and new training and skills that they are trying to build within DVR. And definitely it's going to be a new picture at least a year from now.
Lisa, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
We've been speaking with Lisa Pugh. She's Public Policy Coordinator at Disability Rights Wisconsin.
Coming up next, it's Hidden Wisconsin, and we'll meet an aerial photographer who works with kites instead of planes. But first, Kristen Dish joins us from the newsroom with a look at headlines.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. When Benjamin Franklin attached a key to a kite, it captured electricity. Well, our next guest attached a camera to a kite and captured breathtaking views of Camp Randall, Madeline Island, and other Wisconsin landmarks.
Today in our Hidden Wisconsin segment, we talk to a Madison photographer who shoots his subjects from a unique perspective. He's been called the Ansel Adams of kite aerial photography. Craig Wilson joins us here in the studio. Craig, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm really, really pleased to be here.
So how did you get started with kite aerial photography?
Well, you can imagine 31 years ago, I was a little bit bored, looking for something to do. My wife gave me a kite. I took my carpentry and construction background and fidgeted around in the garage and built another kite, kind of like the one she had given me. And then I decided maybe I needed a bigger one and a better one and another one. And pretty soon I was borrowing sewing machines and making kites. So as those kites got bigger, picture this. You're out flying a kite that now is a 20-foot kite that you've built.
Wow.
And, of course, this is back 30 years ago. So before the internet and, you know, not a lot of guidebooks and directions to tell you exactly how to build the kite, what step to do, what size the framing needed to be and the line might need to be. So I'm out flying this 20-foot kite for the first time. And I thought, well, you know, it might break. It might fly. It might break the line and fly off. I better have my camera with me to get that picture of this kite that I've put all this work into. So the kite ends up flying very nicely, but then this light bulb moment happened when I'm holding the kite with one hand and my camera up to my eye with the other. And I go, oh, well, that's easily enough power to lift that weight of this camera. I simply have to, that's got to be the next thing I do, is actually lift the camera with this kite.
Well, we posted some of your work to our Facebook page because that's the first thing people will want to see, images of what it looks like from a kite. And so some of those are up there on Facebook. But as a kite photographer, what are some of your favorite images to capture?
Well, you know, the difference, I think, in what I was able to do and what I discovered quickly is to be able to take the camera to a little bit unusual heights, you know, above what you might get from the roof, but not the same views you might get from an airplane. And what I really liked about the images that I started to get were that they included people. You know, like most of your aerial photos that you would see taken from satellites and airplanes and so on, you know, you can find a house and you might be able to see a car, but you're not going to see people and you're not going to understand, you know, how they're sort of interacting, you know, on the in the world. And so from the kite's view of maybe 50 feet or maybe as much as a few hundred, you know, that to me was where the interest was. It was sort of the aerial close up, if you will. So I find myself drawn to any kind of place or location that has human activity, because I find, you know, that viewpoint is just really amazing and really refreshing.
Well, you brought a couple of your books in, and I'm looking at a view just over Miss Forward's head on the state capitol. How fun is that to just take these iconic places in Wisconsin and get a kite's eye view on them?
Well, it's a blast, to be honest. And of course, you know, this effort didn't start out with beautiful pictures of the top of the Capitol. They started off being, you know, actually pretty technically flawed, crooked, out of focus, overexposed pictures of my side of my house or part of my house. But I right away recognized the interesting perspective. And so I pursued it and then found myself, you know, getting better equipment, getting better able to operate that equipment, and then taking that camera and my kites to sort of more locations that you don't think of as being sort of kite fields, so like over the Capitol. And of course, with permission.
Well, you said already that this is not an average kite that you get at the drugstore. This is a 20-foot kite that it sounds like you built yourself. So without getting too technical on us, how do you get the camera on there and how do you get it to, you know, just keep taking pictures?
So I have several kites, just like a golfer wouldn't have just one club to go shoot around a golf. I have maybe 6 or 8 kites that I can use to lift the camera. And what I do is, you know, and I choose the kite based on wind speeds and the sight conditions and so on. And then I actually let the kite up a few hundred feet and then connect the camera into its little holder that I'm able to radio control and turn and tilt and trip the shutter. Actually gets mounted not directly to the kite, but actually connected to the line. And then I just let out more line to take the camera up to the height that I want to take it.
When I think kites in my personal life, I think failure. And I also think of Charlie Brown's kite-eating tree. How many kite disasters have you had? What are some of the challenges in keeping it in the air and not losing your gear?
You know, there's always a guy that wants to hear about the disasters.
That's me.
Yeah. I've never really ruined any cameras. I've never dropped or even bumped or damaged. The very first camera rig that I built, I could still use today.
Impressive.
I've worn out a lot of kites because I fly a lot, and I'm sort of into everything kites, not just lifting cameras with them. But, you know, and I've gone through a number of different phases. You know, it started off with a camera that was sort of looked like something Rube Goldberg would put together with rubber bands and bent paper clips and epoxied timers, and has moved to more radio controlled and, you know, sort of fully modern automatic digital cameras.
So we've heard a lot lately about drones and what they can and can't do legally, concerns people have. Have you run into things like that, laws and restrictions about kite photography?
Yeah, you know, kites fall under a different part of the FAA regulations than do motorized and drones. So, you know, I'm kind of sitting here back, kind of enjoying the conversation because it doesn't really impact me, but at least I'm hoping it won't ultimately impact me. But
it sounds like you get permission.
Yeah, and I don't need to be licensed. Like, you know, if you were going to do drone, you know, photography from a drone right now, I think you'd need to have some sort of licensing. It just falls under different parts of the regulations. But, you know, I've been doing this for about 25 years or 26 years, so I'm just kind of enjoying the ride of now such a expanded interest in low-altitude aerial photography.
Hmm.
If someone at home is thinking, yeah, I'd like to try this, how would you suggest someone get started?
Well, if you Google kite aerial photography, you'll find that there's a number of people doing it, and there's a lot of really helpful forums and places like Flickr and little news groups that people kind of, you know, converse around the world. And so it's not as obscure as you might think. And quite honestly, there's a very fascinating history that goes back to about the 1880s of men and, I think mostly men back at that time, using kites to lift cameras.
Now, you mentioned earlier that it's a 20-foot kite, not to keep harping on the kite, but I'm trying to visualize, like, do you hold it and you run with it, this 20-foot kite? Is that how you get it in the air?
No. That's what Charlie Brown would do.
And that's, and Rob, apparently.
Yeah, and Rob. Yeah, yeah. That's not really how a good kite would work. You know, typically, think of a kite like a sailboat. You know, a big sailboat with a big sail can just simply put up its sail in even a very gentle wind, and the sail fills and the boat begins to move. And it's sort of like that with a kite, too. You can assemble the sail and lift the nose and the wind gets under it, and it just, you know, it starts to lift. And
you make it sound kind of like a precision instrument, is it? Can you get precise with a kite?
Yeah, in fact, one of the other elements of my kiting is to do indoor kite flying with very high performance and very very precise ability to fly in a very enclosed spaces. And
So what is on your list of places to photograph this year?
Well, one of my absolute favorite places is up in the Apostle Islands. I go up there every year and actually do a kite making class at the Madeline Island School of the Arts on Madeline Island. And that always gives me a chance to spend some extra time exploring the islands. And I don't know, anyone that's been there knows that you can spend a lot of time there and not have seen everything there is to see. So even though it's fun to go to completely new places, and I do have that opportunity with my kites and cameras, but I almost rather prefer to go back to places and explore them on a deeper level, you know, once you have a little bit of familiarity with a place, to go back and explore it deeper is great. So I'm looking forward to going back there this summer. And I've also drawn to the cranberry harvesting up in central Wisconsin and have gone up to capture that a few times lately. And we'll go back there this year for sure.
Craig, thanks. It sounds like a lot of fun, and the pictures are great. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
That was Craig Wilson, a kite aerial photographer, author of A Little More Line, A Kite's View of Wisconsin and Beyond. We have some of his pictures on the Central Time Facebook page.
If you want to be a guest on Hidden Wisconsin and tell us about the work that you do, or you want to nominate somebody else who has an interesting job here in Wisconsin, or maybe a job that's a little unsung, call our hotline. It's 855-683-5422. That's 855-683-5422 or email centraltime@wpr.org.
Still to come today, from going Gangnam Style to the rants of an NFL player, our next guest will help explain what exactly makes something go viral. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.